Welcome to this month's edition of Headliners. I'm Mary Nichols, Dean of the College of Continuing Education, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to tonight's discussion of book publishing in the digital age. So I suppose I should ask you to turn off your Kindles and Nooks and stuff, just in case. I'd like to thank our media sponsors, MinnPost and Minnesota Public Radio, for their ongoing and loyal support of this and our other Learning Life programs. Appropriately enough, and I'm sure as you well know, both are leaders in digital technology. Last summer, online bookseller Amazon made news when it announced that for the first time, it was selling twice as many ebooks as hardcover editions. Book publishing is currently going through its most profound period of change in two centuries. The economic and technological changes of the 18th century gave rise to the modern novel, which was widely considered vulgar and immoral by readers of that time. Maybe some still are. Today, many fear that printed books will be driven into extinction by 21st century digital technology. So what is the future of the book in an age preoccupied with computers, e-readers, and cell phone technology? And how is the book publishing industry responding to today's rapidly changing technologies? Tonight's speaker has been actively involved in book publishing for the past 30 years and has been interviewed on this issue by media ranging from USA Today to Minnesota Public Radio, which you might have heard recently. Douglas Armato has been director of the University of Minnesota Press since 1998. After graduating from Columbia in 1979, he went to work in the marketing department of Columbia University Press, where, as he puts it, he started his career behind an IBM Selectric typewriter, writing dust jacket copy. During his career, he's also worked at Louisiana State University Press, the University of Georgia Press, where he became an acquiring editor, and the Johns Hopkins University Press, where he served as associate director and manager of the book's publishing division. In 2004, he was named president of the Association of American University Presses, the world's largest organization of nonprofit scholarly publishers. Please join me in welcoming Douglas Armato.
Thanks, Mary. I just wanted to start by showing people both of my copies of Boccaccio's The Decameron. There's this edition. This was published in 1952 by the Folio Society, and I bought this in a used bookstore on 4th Street in Minneapolis. And then there's this edition. And this came to me via a satellite in a fixed orbit over the Earth. It took about 44 seconds to arrive, and in fact, it was free. So those are my two copies, and that's basically what we're talking about tonight, this moment when we haven't really made a transition, when almost everything is becoming available in both electronic and in print form. That's the sort of moment of balance that we're at. So the first thing which I sort of want to get out there is, who would have thought that we would need to ask ourselves what a book is? Since the book as a form replaced the scroll in the 3rd or 4th century AD, we have used that one term, book, to mean both the physical object of sheets of paper bound on one side and also the ideas and stories contained within that object. No one confuses a bottle with its contents, whether wine, pickles, or a message. No one confuses a box with what is shipped or stored within it, or a television set with the programs that are beamed onto its screen, or a symphony orchestra with the plastic compact disc on which its performance is recorded. But the word book has long meant both form and content, and now with the rise of e-readers, Kindle, Nook, Sony, and their lesser-known brethren from JetBook to Eclicto, that would seem to be changing and changing fast. Or is it? That's the big question. After all, long after the book itself became the dominant form in the Christianized Roman Empire, the scroll held onto its popularity in some corners of the known world, particularly pagan Greece and the Near East, where it had been invented. In the 10th novel of the Dance to the Music of Time series by the British social novelist Anthony Powell, a pompous magazine editor named Bagshaw has carefully shepherded his book collection through World War II and the devastation of the London Blitz. Reaching for a single volume on the top shelf of a glass-fronted bookcase to confirm a poetry quote, the entire collection of lovingly protected books comes crashing down to the floor and him under it. His dazed response gives that novel its title, Books Do Furnish a Room. E.M. Forster, too, imagined such a cataclysm in the novel Howard's End, when the poor clerk Leonard Bast, who spends all his scant money on learning and literature, topples a bookcase onto himself and dies of a heart attack beneath the thud of the volumes that mean more to him than life. Far more orderly is the vision of the great Argentinian writer Jorge Luis Borges, who in his story The Library of Babel imagined a universal library made up of six-sided honeycomb chambers like a beehive, each outfitted with four cases of books, each of which contains 20 shelves, each of which holds 35 books of exactly 410 pages, each page of which has exactly 40 lines made up of exactly 80 letters. This library contains all books, whether brilliant or composed of pure gibberish, and each book appears on the outside like all the others, though the words that are stamped on the uniform black spines hold no clue as to what their exact contents are. If the books that cascade onto Bagshaw and poor Leonard Bast call to mind our own unruly shelves and stacks of books, hardcover, paperback, various sizes and page counts, distinctive typographic designs, unique cover art, the books, that is, that crowd our houses, make our way to basement boxes, remote storage units, used bookstores, garage sales, and even prop up a table or a window air conditioner sometimes. If that's the books we know, then Borges' pristine library of letters and punctuation in uniform dress brings to my mind nothing so much as the massive computer server farms of Amazon, Google, and other ebook purveyors, where three centuries of the written word, transmuted into the ones and zeros of binary code, await access by readers any time of the day, pretty much anywhere on the globe. I think these stories help get at the dilemma faced today by book lovers, whether they be publishers or librarians or students or avid readers. The attachment to the physical books that seem like a part of us versus the excitement, not to mention incredible convenience, of having millions of volumes at our fingertips available on a device that weighs 10 ounces or less. And, like so many other issues in our society today, there are fierce partisans on either side of the question. There are those who love their e-readers, denounce the physical form of the written word as dead tree books, and consider the maximum price they should pay to read any e-book at the $9.99 established by Amazon at the outset of the Kindle age. And there are those who consider it sacrilege to dispose of a book, including a group of book designers who created a video, posted on YouTube, ironically, in which they assaulted a Kindle with a baseball bat, or the publisher who included the slogan, "Kill your Kindle," on the cover of its catalog. And then there are the cultural pundits. Yes, the book world has pundits as well, such as the critic and provocateur Nicholas Negroponte, who confidently announced this past August that the physical book is dead in 5 years. To which one book-loving blogger responded, "Just because spaghetti sauce is available in a jar doesn't mean there will be no more Italian restaurants." Still, we've all witnessed newspapers shrink and cease publication as readers go online for news. We've watched record stores disappear as music has been subdivided into tunes. We've seen the entire postal service shrivel as people communicate, pay bills, stream movies, and even send greeting cards on websites. Why would books not go the same way? Before I try and answer that, let's look at another question. Why are books seen as so important in the digital age? And why is there such a controversy over their fate? And why are corporate behemoths such as Google and Apple fighting over the book market? After all, isn't reading itself dying? Aren't people's attention spans used up by websites, video games, hundreds of cable television channels, and every other aspect of wired existence? The National Endowment for the Arts itself raised the alarm on the decline in leisure reading in a 2004 report, that concluded that there is a general collapse in advanced literacy and showed that fewer than half of American adults read even one book a year, and that the reading rate for teens had dropped an alarming 28% over just two decades. Apple's founder and technological impresario, Steve Jobs, himself dismissed his competitor Amazon's Kindle in 2008, saying that it doesn't matter whether it's a good device or not because people don't read anymore. But then 2 years later, when Jobs introduced the iPad, he surprised many by featuring a very prominent iBookstore to parallel the iTunes music and video store. So why did Steve Jobs change his mind and make books so prominent on the iPad? Why, as the Wall Street Journal reported on Monday, is Google launching a whole new business centered on books? Why does Sony, which lost the digital music marketplace to Apple in the Walkman to iPod transition, pin its hopes for revival on ebooks? Why is Amazon.com, with books as its core business, now seen by Forbes as the biggest threat to Walmart and potentially the dominant American retailer of the next decade? Let's look at the money. The retail book market in the U.S. alone, bookstores and direct-to-consumer sales, conservatively totals $24 billion. That doesn't count books sold to libraries or professional publishing, such as legal, medical, and engineering reference works and texts. The total U.S. publishing market is estimated at around $35 billion annually. Of entertainment industries, books only trail the motion picture and DVD industry at $55 billion in annual revenues, and they're well ahead of television at $22 billion, video games at $19 billion, and music at just $6 billion. Of the $35 billion in book industry revenues, only 7% is from digital, and that is after extraordinary growth in ebook sales of 207% this past year alone. So Apple and Google and Amazon and Sony are fighting over the ebook market because there's a lot of money there. And what about readers, whom the NEA report suggested are disappearing? Well, the NEA report looked at all adults, culture vultures and couch potatoes inclusive, and not specifically at readers, a devoted audience who, other surveys suggest, identify closely with books throughout their lifespans. Indeed, the picture is more encouraging if you look at the sizable number of adults, including young adults, who do read, rather than focusing, as the NEA does, on those who do not. A recent demographically balanced survey by Verso Advertising of nearly 10,000 book readers found, and this number I think is amazing, that there were 62 million avid readers in the United States, those who spend 5 hours or more a week reading. And that nearly 30% of those readers say they purchase more than 10 books a month. In the 18 to 24 age group, which is one of those groups that the NEA report suggested was being lost, 22% of avid readers spent more than 5 hours a week, 22% of readers spent more than 5 hours a week reading for pleasure, and 28% of those younger readers are committed enough to reading to have gone looking for and downloaded books illegally. Of avid readers, it should be noted, 37% are men and 63% are women, though most of the illegal downloaders are men. The same survey suggests that at this early stage in ebook market penetration, 53% of avid readers want nothing to do with ebooks whatsoever. While 7% already own an e-reader, another 8% are likely to buy one in the next few months, 16% are considering a purchase within the next year. Interestingly, 30% of ebook users say they will still buy at least 10 print books in the next year, and just 13% say they'll only buy ebooks and nothing else. Thus far, then, book lovers seem maybe equally divided between those who want print books only and those who are open to ebooks, many of whom actually say they'll still buy print. Where does this leave publishers and booksellers? That's obviously a question of great interest to me. The doomsday scenario is that of the music industry, which was dragged kicking and screaming into the digital era and literally sued its own customers in federal court for damages to prevent music from escaping the once dominant CD format. It didn't work. Since the introduction of the iPod just a decade ago, music industry revenues have shrunk by more than half in a decade. Even as lost CD revenues have been offset to some extent by digital music sales, nearly 80% of the songs for sale on Apple's monopolistic iTunes store never sell a single copy in a year. Record stores themselves are rare, even in cities. Bookstores feel similarly stressed. As Amazon increasingly dominates the market for both print books, reports suggest it'll surpass Barnes & Noble as the nation's largest bookseller this year, gaining a 15% market share. And also ebooks, where it has a 60% market share, though apparently Apple is beginning to cut into that. As one independent bookseller put it recently, bookselling is an 8-inch pie that keeps getting more forks coming into it. For us, the first fork was the chains, the second fork was Amazon, now it's digital downloads. Astoundingly, sales to independent booksellers in aggregate have actually increased modestly for each of the last 3 years, while the large bookselling chains, Barnes & Noble and Borders, have retrenched significantly. Barnes & Noble has cut title selection in the face of a 3.3% decline in same-store sales this past year and cleared display space for live demonstrations of their Nook and Nook Color e-readers. Borders has announced store closures and seems to be relying on the introduction of Build-A-Bear teddy bear kiosks in their stores to survive their even more precipitous sales downturn. Still, when Duluth bookseller Anita Zager announced yesterday that she would sell or close her Northern Lights bookstore, the reason she gave was simply ebooks. Remembering that 93% of book sales are still from print, publishers are highly concerned about the stress on bookstores, even as they see a great potential for revenue increases in ebooks. Partly for that reason, publishers have resisted the undercutting of print book prices by Amazon in particular, that famous $9.99 price. But publishers are also rapidly digitizing frontlist and backlist books and negotiating distribution deals with ebook vendors in what amounts to, in reality, a whole new business from that of shipping physical objects coast to coast and around the world. In effect, publishers are trying to run two businesses at once. At the University of Minnesota Press, we've approached the digital environment aggressively. 3 years ago, we announced that we had put back into print via digital technology every single book the press had published and for which we still had rights since our founding in 1925. Partnering with Amazon and Google, we brought 1,008 books back into print, the first university press in the nation to digitize its backlist systematically. This past summer, we flowed our entire active and rights-cleared list of about 1,400 titles to both Amazon Kindle and the soon-to-be-launched Google editions, and will now be simultaneously issuing all future titles in print and ebook editions. In 2011, we expect to make our titles available as well to Barnes & Noble's Nook, the Canadian-based Kobo, and other e-devices. Meanwhile, we're also part of two different consortia working to make university press books digitally available through university libraries and to integrate them with the already established electronic editions of scholarly journals. As director of the press, I spend as much as half of every work week on digital publishing, which still accounts for about 4% of our annual revenues. We're betting time, effort, and money that digital will pay off for us. Because the reality is that no one in the book business really knows what the outcome of the digital transition will look like or how complete that transition will be. Conferences abound on the future of the publishing business and the death of the book, with experts mixing fact and speculation in a manner eerily reminiscent of 1999's Y2K frenzy. Some say publishers, as well as booksellers and librarians, should fear what is known as disintermediation, by which the intermediaries that lie between authors and readers are eliminated by desktop publishing technologies that can make anyone an author or a publisher or both at once. Others argue that once the book has been freed from its container of binding author and copyright, text can be remixed into new works by anyone, interpolated with other books, articles, blog posts, Facebook debates, tweets, and for that matter, images, sounds, video, anything you can think of, all of which can flow into and out of one another into a post-authorial wordscape very close to the one Borges imagined in the Library of Babel, in which you'll recall gibberish was mixed indiscriminately with profundity. And so coming full circle back to Borges' live, hive-like library and to the tottering books that overwhelmed Anthony Powell's Bagshaw and E.M. Forster's Bast, we reach the story of Professor Andrew Helevace, a scholar of interactive communication at Quinnipiac University in Connecticut. Until recently, Helevace had shared a cramped New York City apartment with his wife, a toddler, and 5,000 books. I say until recently because this past year, Helevace began the process of reducing the space devoted to his collection of books by personally digitizing them, cutting off the bindings with a table saw, feeding the disbound pages into a scanner, running an optical character recognition program to convert the image files to searchable text, and then copying the digital files onto a networked external disk drive. As of September, Helevace had converted 1,000 books from paper to magnetic storage. By my calculation, that is a reduction in space usage from about 150 linear feet of reading matter to a single rectangle of about 3x5x1.5 inches. He says he plans to retain about 50 books out of the 5,000, including his mother's copy of Marx's Das Kapital. In an interview with the Chronicle of Higher Education, Helevace admitted to some qualms about guillotining his book collection one by one. He said, "I'm over 1,000 books in, and even now I get that, especially with hardcovers for some reason, that gut feeling of, will I be judged for doing this?" Destroying books, he said, is very difficult. When Andrew Helevace says destroying books is very difficult, I think he's speaking for many of us, indeed for the culture as a whole. It is hard not to get excited about having literally millions of volumes available in a few keystrokes, a digital library of Alexandria hovering around and above us, suspended galactically in Google's and Amazon's and Apple's and Kobo's and Sony's ferromagnetic cloud. But it is also hard to let go of the human act of browsing in a bookstore, discovering a volume you've never heard about, of turning pages and moving your bookmarks slowly through the bulk of a beautifully designed book, of giving to others or passing down to children the books you've loved, of looking up at a cramped bookshelf and reaching up to reread a favorite, being very, very careful not to have the whole weighty shelf, which to me represents the publishing and bookselling industry itself, crash down on your shoulders. Thank you.
Doug, thank you so much. We want to open it up for your questions now. Where do you want to start?
So what happens to libraries? And I'm thinking in particular not so much of academic libraries as public libraries and the lending of physical books.
Libraries are finding very rapidly that that they have more customers than ever, and that almost all of those customers and patrons are at computer terminals and not in the stacks. Rather than taking out physical books, they're on the internet. However, they also are able to serve their communities in a networked way because they're loaning books online. In fact, there's a vendor that works specifically with libraries called Overdrive that loans books out online to their patrons. The odd thing about it is that the way things are working, the digital copies are loaned one by one, so you get in the same dumb queue you'd get in for the physical book, which doesn't actually seem to make a lot of sense in the digital environment, but that seems to be where it is right now.
One of the questions I have, for example, with music, everything got pirated and all of a sudden there was no money in it anymore for the artist. And what happens here? What protects copyright? Why should someone go to the effort to write a book if it's just going to be circulated and they gain nothing from it?
Well, I mean, a lot of music still is sold. The pirating, which happened especially with Napster in the early days, was before there was an alternate to digital music. Apple's iTunes came along and actually created that paying market. And that is sort of resulted in a philosophy which gets bandied around a lot in publishing circles, which is that people prefer easy to free. That if you can give them something which allows them for not too much cost to get a hold of something in digital form, they'll actually buy it. Whereas if you don't, then they'll find a way to get it. And that way often is piracy. So really where the music industry went wrong, and that's why I say it's a worst case scenario, we're really grateful in a way that it went wrong, because now we know exactly what not to do, was that they tried to stop all digital dissemination of music. They tried to just say, we don't want it to happen. We want you to buy these plastic, silvery-looking discs. And so people found other ways to do it, and that was Napster, and that's where the culture of piracy started.
You made the comparison between the books as well as the movies and the music, and I see a lot of similarities there, especially in movies. People aren't even getting the discs anymore. They're just getting it online.
Right.
And so it seems it's really becoming a whole cultural shift of wanting the content and not the form. Is there something we're not considering when you're just looking at books, movies, and music? What's after that? Is there anything else that people are considering?
I don't know about that. I mean, the movie industry is interesting in a couple ways, but one big difference, which might make books different, and this may not answer your question, is that there's 175,000 new books published in the United States every year. Whereas there aren't even 2,000 motion pictures released. So you're dealing with an immense scale when it comes to books, which make them a little more unique than the movies are themselves. But I do think that books, to answer what I think is part of your question, are the last truly undigitized form. And that's changing rapidly. There won't be a new book which isn't available digitally in another 2 or 3 years.
About content that's in the book, once it's digitized, how, if I'm the buyer of the book, how do I know I'm getting accurate or the original content?
Well, I think you want to buy from a reputable dealer. When we move into the digital environment, one thing which I think we're seeing is that publishers are preserving in the digital environment their own imprint. So if you go to Amazon's site to download a book, it'll tell you who publishes it. And if it's someone you've heard of or someone, you know, that seems major, then it's probably a real book. If it's some company that has a name like, you know, Funny Egg Books or something like that, you know, it might be a little bit of a risk. And at the end of the day, price is also going to mean something, that when you see something online that is $1.99, chances are it's not a real book at the end of the day. So there are some clues out there.
I guess the follow-up to that is that if places like the Pentagon can be hacked, how are the publishers keeping their content secure from just like WikiLeaks?
Yeah, once it's digitized, it's going to be out there, and it really is a matter of just, you know, making it easy for people to get in a reliable, responsible, easy way. There already, we find many of our books out online, and we write cease and desist letters. Most of the pirates are based in Eastern Europe or Russia or China, and you shut down one site, and the exact same site pops up in another geographic. They may all be operating out of a one-room apartment, you know, somewhere in, you know, somewhere in Magnitogorsk. I mean, we don't really know where any of this is happening, but we even see our books out there. And you just write letters and try and shut them down. But at the end of the day, I think that the issue is that you want to make the stuff available relatively easily to people so that their first thought is, I can get this from Google or I can get this from Apple, rather than I'm going to go through, you know, 200 different search results looking for a free copy.
Or at least maybe the women will, right?
Yeah.
We heard that part. Back over here.
A disproportional amount of that $35 billion is in the textbook industry. And in the textbook business is in terms of number of products sold.
Mm-hmm.
And the textbook industry really doesn't care about the actual book itself. What they care about is the mantra of every student pays. You know, that's what we say over and over.
Mm-hmm.
And it's more about buying or purchasing access to a disposable commodity. You know, we don't want to sell used books. We want to change that ISBN every year with some type of consumable, hopefully a value add, but it doesn't really have to be a value add as long as it changes that ISBN. And we're now moving into this.
Oh, you caught on to all this, I see.
Oh, yeah. I've been in that realm for quite a while. And we're now moving into, we're no longer selling the book. What we're trying to do is sell access to a learning experience.
Yeah.
And I'm just kind of wondering your thoughts on you know, and again, the textbook is always tied to a particular course, and the notion of the course is dying in favor of a programmatic solution to learning. And so I'm just wondering where you think some of those things are headed.
Yeah, the textbook publishers on the one hand really love the idea of the digital environment. I mean, what you describe about, you know, new releases constantly, it's like what in, you know, what in the software business is called the upgrade path. You know, you never get off it. I mean, you know, that Apple constantly wants you to upgrade, constantly, you know, enforces you getting a more powerful computer. And so the textbook publishers see a real advantage potentially in the digital environment. Because they can get rid of the used book market, which they would argue has been what's driven this mania for constantly, you know, for constantly creating new editions and for constantly, you know, updating texts. They also would find the digital environment very attractive because they can customize heavily, which in some markets is a real concern, because in some states there are real strictures placed on what can be in a textbook and what's taught. So I think that the textbook market is still going to change a lot. The odd statistic which has come out is that students by and large have been saying they don't like the digital editions of textbooks that have been released thus far, that if they're going to pay a lot of money, they'd rather have it in print. They'd rather have the print version. And the textbook experiments haven't been very successful yet. So I think that's something that's still going to evolve.
Why do you think that is, Doug, on the part of students? Why are they not adopting them, the e-books?
I think that my own sense and what a couple students have said is that with any book that you spend a lot of time with, you don't actually want it digital unless you can truly sort of mark it up, make it your own in some way. But the more time you spend with something, the more you actually do want it in physical form. Where people really like digital is when they just want to dip into something or read a little bit of it, just the part that pertains to what they're doing.
Of course, the students underline with these highlighters and make marginal notes and so forth. We have a question right over here.
We have a question over here from an honor student.
All right.
Hi. I was just wondering if this could, or the use of these e-books could actually be used to sort of foster a love of books. I guess I come from a pocket of students in the last generation that still love our books.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, we loved having, you know, there's like book groups and book discussions, and it seems like since these e-readers also go online, there are all these opportunities where you could have links within the books to actual book discussions, so you could be discussing these books and similar books that you also love with people all across the globe.
I think that there's a lot of people who exactly would like to see that happening. There's a movement within higher education called Digital Humanities. And digital humanities is focused on the idea that students are and will need to be just as familiar with digital means of communicating as they are with written, with print things and with written things. And digital humanities is trying to build within universities an environment for that happening. And we already know that universities drive the culture. They drive creativity. It's where a lot of things are first introduced that make their way into the broader culture. So I think there's a lot of hope in the digital humanities movement for the kind of thing you describe.
You know, the audience may be interested that we kind of collaborate with the honors program at the university and make sure that honors students have a chance to come and hear their professors, and they many each night take advantage of that. So we're always happy to have students here. And we have a question up front here.
Would you discuss the demise of newspapers and journalism?
Newspapers are a sort of interesting case, and I'm not a newspaper publisher, so I can only relate it to the book industry. But again, as with the music industry, we look at everyone in crisis and try and figure out what we can learn from that. And one thing we've learned from newspapers is what's called ingloriously in our business chunking. That newspapers are very susceptible, as is music, to just taking what you want. Newspapers can be broken down into articles very easily, into listings. Books are harder. Books are a long-form argument, and that makes them a little bit different than either songs or newspapers. I think both music and newspapers have suffered to some extent from the fact that it's just so easy to break them into small parts. I think that's been one part of it. That said, the newspaper industry is actually really big. It's about $37 billion still, even at this point. There is a lot of money there. Some people argue that the newspapers are almost victims of their own success, that for a time that they were so profitable that they attracted a lot of buyers who heavily leveraged them and created sort of their own debt crisis, sort of like what Ireland is and Greece are going through now. But I do think that books and also movies as long form are less likely to be damaged in the environment than either music or newspapers.
Interesting. Question in the center here.
What about the ephemeral nature of digital content? You wouldn't have Boccaccio on that e-reader if generations hadn't kept it in books.
That's one of the great worries. One reason that I have Boccaccio on my e-reader is that it comes from a free resource named Project Gutenberg. And Project Gutenberg was the first to digitize a lot of classic works, and they were digitized by people sitting there with the text and keyboarding them. Almost like if any of you saw François Truffaut's movie of Fahrenheit 451, where everyone is walking around reciting the books to preserve them. Project Gutenberg, everyone just literally typed them in, and that's what you're reading when you read one of those books. Project Gutenberg's free, and what you always worry about is that things that don't make money at some point go away. They don't get moved to the next technology, that they just could not be maintained or disappear. And so I think that is a real concern. Some librarians have actually suggested that maybe we only need one copy of every book, one print copy, sort of held, you know, like in that big mountain in Colorado where they have the headquarters with the nuclear missiles. Some people have thought that we could just do that and then everything else could be digitally. But that does make me real nervous. The last thing I'll say about that topic is that this whole thing was again rehearsed by newspapers about 40 years ago in the microfiche disaster. And what happened is that many, many libraries around the country had full runs in their libraries of like every issue of newspapers bound in these big, massive volumes. And they all were disposed of about 40 years ago, largely. They were turned into microfiche because it was seen to be better. And in fact, it's degraded. There's very few copies of the originals left, and a novelist, Nicholson Baker, who some here may have read, literally spent a lot of the royalties from his first four books buying up the remaining copies of these newspapers, because he saw it as the only way to save that bit of history. So yeah, it's a real concern.
Interesting. Let's go to the front row here.
Speaking of money, I guess the market has kind of set a price for paper books. You know, what is it, $20, $30, something around in there.
Mm-hmm.
And some of that money goes to publishers and some is for distribution logistics, for artwork, and I guess even the author gets a little bit. So have you got an idea of like what an ebook could cost, would cost, aside from the $9.99 set by Amazon?
Yeah, I think that's all going to get settled. It does seem pretty certain that authors will get more in the electronic environment than they have in the print environment, because the costs by and large are less. The big cost for books, though, isn't even really just the physical printing. It's like Jimmy Stewart and It's a Wonderful Life, that the successful authors actually pay for the authors who haven't become successful yet. You know, the money isn't in the bank just sort of sitting there because it's Joe's money. It's actually in Ed's hardware store. And so I think that, you know, one of the reasons why the $9.99 price that Amazon for a while was able to force on publishers, you know, was creating a problem was is that there was a sense that, yeah, $9.99 is great if you're going to sell 100,000 copies of something, but it isn't so great if you're only going to sell 2,000 copies of something, because then it won't really pay to keep everyone employed. So it's still settling. My guess is that ebook prices are going to look a lot like paperback prices. That's my guess.
But not necessarily be based on real cost, underlying cost, just more what you can get.
On different kinds of costs. The cost of printing a book is generally about 20% of the total cost of making a book.
Okay. We have a question. Margie, where'd you go? Back
here. I think it's kind of a follow-up to the library, but I'm thinking about access to literature and books, the information book. Kind of like the monks, you know, who did the handwork with books. There was a whole group in the society who had no access to that. It kind of seemed to be those who had the haves could have mm-hmm. access to this particular thing. Could that happen again? Libraries have always been the way that many people can access books and literature from children to adults. If I can't afford an e-book or the i, whatever it might be, how will I have access? Will we, you know, have a class of those who have access to literature and information as opposed to those who do not?
I think we're going to have an incredible era for libraries ahead. I think it's going to be astounding. As I said, right now, the way libraries are digitally owning things is that they're still loaning them out one by one, but I don't think that can last. I think libraries are going to buy ebooks on the open market, and I think they're going to lend them out to people pretty regularly. The best thing about it is going to be that, you know, a library anywhere, you know, most places in the world is going to be able to get a hold of any book, and that's going to be the really exciting part. That the people who once might not have been served by a good library, either because they were in a, you know, poor part of the world or otherwise, they're going to be able to get these incredible works. You know, and it's part of what's referred to as the challenge of the digital divide. That what we really have to do is get internet service, basically, and access to digital media more evened out around the globe. But I think it's going to be a great era for libraries.
Interesting. In the center here.
I don't like to bring up a subject that's already been talked about to some degree, but when you were talking about textbooks, I got the feeling that you were talking about pretty much higher education. But in the K through 12 schools, the publishers have been doing pretty well with charging anywhere from $35 to $70 a book. And that's a pretty strong revenue stream for the publishers, and I'm curious about how you see that developing, and also in terms of what schools have to provide in terms of readers and so on, if that's going to change over to a digital format.
I really think it's bound to turn over to a digital format. But I think that at this point, most of the e-readers that have been developed are really for consumers. They're not for education. They don't create a experience which I think really works as well for students, because you can annotate a little bit but not much. You can get lost in things. I mean, for instance, something as simple as page references are crazy on a Kindle because there's no pages. You know, if you're reading a Kindle, you know, it'll tell you that you're 16.7% into the book. It won't tell you what page it is. So at this point, I don't think, oddly enough, the education market has really been addressed. But it's going to be addressed, I think, in the next few years. It's not necessarily my part of the business, but I do know that there's a lot of publishers who are very concerned with the fate of text publishing, you know, as this transition goes forward.
Question in the back in the center here.
Thank you. I wonder if there is any talk or any thought about the losses that all this technology can bring. You talked about when you have a book that you want to mark in and so on, that students prefer to hold the book, have the book, rather than have it on a Kindle or an e-book. I would prefer to get a letter than an email. If I'm text messaging my friend, I don't get to hear her voice. I don't get to see her face. All this technology, I think, has many advantages, but I think it brings some losses, and I think the loss is in some way connectivity. And does anyone ever talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is something that, you know, we're all sort of fearing that loss and waiting to see where the balance comes. You know, when I mentioned the post office earlier, we see something which has been totally transformed by email, you know, which has lost, you know, so much of physical correspondence. We don't really know what's going to happen with books yet. We don't know whether books will become luxury items, whether they'll be something which people, you know, really cherish more because they don't buy as many. It's just very hard to know right now. Some people have talked about that the ebook market might at the end of the day be sort of like the audiobook market, that it might be something which is sort of exists alongside physical books but doesn't really replace them the way it seems to have in music, and that it seems to be on the way to doing in newspapers, and that it certainly has in correspondence. But like I said, we really don't know what's going to happen. But a lot of people, you know, who love books hate the idea of all of this, you know, great culture of books disappearing.
Question over on the left here.
I recently had a business research project where I went to the university library, mm-hmm. and did very in-depth research both in the stacks with paper books and journals and everything, and also the electronic resources. And I was struck by the noticeable difference in terms of the learning that I was doing. Some things were better in print, some things were better online in terms of both searching and actually processing the information. How much do we know about that part of all of this in terms of which ways are better to get the information, and for what types of things are print better versus digital?
Well, what people say is lost in the digital environment is the word that comes up very often is kismet. It's finding what you aren't expecting, which the digital environment is exceedingly good for creating search terms and finding and sort of narrowing down to you get what you're looking for. What they say doesn't happen as much is finding what you aren't looking for, you know, just sort of coming across information. You know you're looking for this book, but three books down in the stacks, there's something which turns out to be really pertinent to what you're doing. So I think that's one thing which people believe. It's also generally said that the digital environment is much better for information than it is for argument, that you get... that it's very good for finding access to information, but if you want interpretation, it's much more difficult because you're only seeing part of the picture. Books are this massive argument with each other. You know, that basically you can read a book that sets out an argument, but it's arguing with 6 or 10 books that have gone before, or several more that will come, or several more that are in process, that there's a sort of network there. And it's just very hard to know where you're entering that sometimes in the digital form, because everything's coming to you out of context. So that's one thing which has been talked about. Some of the projects we're involved in digitizing books, actually are attempting to pull together all of this material in a way that would make the kind of work you were doing much easier, that would allow a free flow from journal literature to reference works to interpretive books and all the way back, in fact, to collections. Special collections of original sources. So there's a thought that out of this we might come up with an incredibly rich library experience. And the only problem is that someone's going to have to pay for it.
Question here in the center, please.
What kind of strategies are the digital publishing industry developing to replicate the browsing experience of walking through a bookstore, if any?
That is really a big challenge right now, and everyone is focused mostly just purely in making the books digital and creating sort of basic search. Beyond that, there's something which is sort of called rich search, which involves trying to, almost the way you do in a social network, almost the way you do in Facebook or in Twitter, that basically tries to create networks of books to show where they fit, which authors fit together, who was commenting on who had communications. These are all some ways that, as the sort of digital environment advances, that it could get really exciting. One thing that we're doing, we're in the middle of developing our new website, and we said, well, you know, for all these years, we've always said that books had subjects, and we've classed them that way. You know, we've said, okay, this is history, this is anthropology, you know, this is biology. And what we're doing instead now, because of the digital environment, is that instead we're tagging them like the way you would in a blog post. We're actually going to be asking authors to go back and say, you know, okay, pick the 10 keywords from this list that describe your book, and use them to try and guide people in a more sort of browsing way. So there's a few things we're trying to do to get at that, but I think it's all going to still emerge.
We just have endless questions. We're really curious about this subject, Doug. Question over here on the left.
One of the questions, the K-12 situation, I thought was very interesting in that there are some publishers of school textbooks that have an inordinate weight in the market, for example, Texas, because of the numbers of books that they produce, and therefore it's so expensive to produce these books, they cater to what Texas wants to say.
Right.
And it would seem to me that if we could digitize these things, we could say what Minnesota wants to say, or you know, a different point of view on the Founding Fathers, on why we had a Civil War, et cetera.
That's sort of a good news, bad news proposition. On the one hand, Minnesota would have its way, but the bad news is that we then wouldn't be able to agree on what actually happened. It's very true, but I think that once what you lose is that sort of unified culture where everyone can, when things get too customized, it's like, oh, I studied with such and such a book, and someone says, oh yeah, I had that in class too, and said, you know, what about that incredible story about Henry Box Brown, you know, the escaped slave who traveled with the box that he'd managed to get himself smuggled out of the South with? And someone else would say, oh, I don't remember that story. Was that in that book? It sort of turns into a bit of a stew.
To the Minnesota perspective, though, we're getting pretty good at recounts anyway.
Yeah.
So, question over here.
I'm curious about the role of editors, and do you see a difference in print versus electronic publishing?
There isn't a difference in it, except that the market is changing a little bit. That the digital environment, people can find things a lot easier. It used to be that in order to be a successful editor, you looked for what a lot of people were interested in. But it's almost at the point now where you can say, well, here's a book that you can find everyone who's interested in it in the world because of the web. You can pick a topic that just some people really care deeply about. And in the old days, you would have had to, 5 years ago, you would have had to convince all the librarians and all the booksellers, yeah, I know you've never heard about this, but it's actually important. And they would say, really? Are you sure? And you'd argue with them, and maybe you would get the way. Now, literally, you know, frankly, you can bypass that system. So you can tell an editor, wow, if you get the book that people are really excited about, but it's on a narrow topic, that may really work for us.
Question back here.
As far as I know, the Kindle does text only. On the books that you have been putting up electronically, what are you doing about artwork? Are you using Adobe Acrobat, or what are you doing?
Well, we're doing a lot of different things. Kindle does show images. They're not pretty, and you can't really tell very well what's going on in them. The Barnes & Noble's Color Nook is a lot better, but images are a bigger problem because the images in the book very often have different copyright than the author. In other words, you know, if you're using a photograph that was taken, you know, in the 70s in a book written by someone now, that photograph, you have to get permission to use it. And so what we have found ourselves doing, and we spent, frankly, 3 years doing this, is that we went through our contract files all the way back, and we figured out where we had rights restrictions and what we couldn't use in the digital environment. And on those books, we actually had to black out those images. And there's some books where there were so many restricted images, we just weren't able to make them available digitally. I gave some numbers earlier about what we're doing digitally, and I said, oh, we put, you know, 1,008 titles back into print. And then I said, we have 1,400 titles that we've made available to Amazon. And that's not a big difference in those. You'd wonder what we were doing all these years. Well, in a lot of cases, we have the rights to print things, but we don't have the rights to show them digitally. And so there's a lot of books we've published that we still had to go through the process of re-clearing rights for illustrations, extracts of poetry, song lyrics, all sorts of stuff, just to be able to make the books available digitally.
Question in the center here.
I'm wondering about the other side of digital, which is print on demand, where it's on digital, but it's printed and only for whoever wants it.
Yeah, print on demand is something we're making a lot of use of. All those books we brought back into print, those 1,008 books are print on demand. There's no reason now why a book has to be out of print unless it's a full color book where you really can't achieve that. And it's terrific. And the even better part about it is that now if someone wants a book in England, you can just print it there. You know, you just send the file to a vendor in England, you print it there. They want it in Australia, you print it there. They want it in Brazil, you print it there. And so it's really a way of making the business a lot more efficient. I mean, one thing that I didn't really talk about is the whole carbon footprint issue. And, you know, publishers have been shipping weighty items worldwide for centuries. And the great thing about print on demand is that it really allows us to be a lot more efficient.
Question in the center here.
Yeah. I am, by any measure, an unknown author. I have a piece of fiction going through copy edit as we speak. When that's done, I do not have an agent. When that's done, should I shop it to a standard publishing house, or should I self-publish in some form?
If you can get a standard publishing house to do it, you should publish it with a standard publishing house, because they'll put a lot of resources behind it. An awful lot of publishing houses spend time looking at what people are self-publishing. They keep very close track on, you know, who's having a success that is just publishing something themselves, or who's getting a lot of buzz on a blog or anything. So publishers are actually scouting for books among self-publishing. When I gave those crazy numbers about how much money the book industry makes, I said they were conservative estimates because some people believe, and this number is really difficult, that on top of that 35 million in retail book sales, that there's another 15 million in self-published books sold every, 15 billion, sorry, in self-published books sold every year. That's what some people say, but it's almost impossible to estimate because they're self-published books. How do you track it? It's just very, very difficult. So there's a lot of people who are getting a lot of books out there themselves.
Question back here on the left, in the back.
If there's a bookstore in 5 years, what does it look like?
Well, my guess is, and this is sad to say, I don't think we're going the way of the record stores. I think there still will be bookstores, but I think they're going to be closer to bookshops. I think they're going to be closer to boutiques. I think they're going to be highly selective. I think they're going to go places where people go to get something special. What I really worry that we're going to lose are the just sort of great general bookstores where you could find just about anything, because those stores are just very, very hard to sustain. The amount of inventory that you have to put in them is difficult. I mean, we are so lucky here that we have two local writers, each of whom are supporting bookstores, you know, with the revenues that they make from books they write. It's very fortunate. But a lot of great bookstores have disappeared. You can sort of maneuver around it, but at the end of the day, I think that the bookstores that are opening now and that are successful have much smaller selections, and they also know their clientele unbelievably well. They know exactly what people are interested in that are around them.
A question here in the center in the back.
In this changing environment, how in general are university presses doing vis-a-vis their more commercial competitors?
Well, we're actually doing pretty well, and it's partly because we haven't been as reliant on the big booksellers like Barnes & Noble and Borders, where a lot of the suffering is coming at this point in terms of the book trade is sort of in the mass end of things. University presses have a lot more focused market. Education, as bad as things are for universities with budget cuts, state budget cuts, federal money in some cases drying up, universities are still in a lot better shape than a lot of other parts of the economy, and our audience is mostly universities. So thus far, we seem to be doing okay. Most university presses this year are selling more books than they did last year.
Aren't we seeing a bit of a shakeout, though, as I read some of the higher ed journals and the like, of number of university presses that are restructuring or closing or what have you?
We've been losing a few presses lately. Most of them are pretty small, but there's a lot of presses under incredible stress right now. There's no way to make money on publishing scholarly monographs. University presses wouldn't exist if there was money in publishing scholarship. We wouldn't be necessary. And so it's always been to some extent subsidized in one way or another. But the digital environment, again, could be a little bit of a game changer there, because once you open up all of this work, you know, globally, there's a lot more people who are going to make use of it. And depending on how the market develops, we might actually end up in a much better place for the digital marketplace than we are now.
Question in the back here.
I have a question about publishing, what you do every day.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, first of all, what do you see? How do you see your office looking in like 5 years? What do you think there'll be major changes within your actual operations? And what would you tell someone who said they wanted to go into publishing now?
Okay. My office is going to be a wreck in 5 years the way it is now. I don't really see any of that changing. It's still going to have stacks of paper because I can't read a 400-page manuscript on screen. My eyeballs will dry out. It's just not going to happen. As we know, the digital environment has caused us globally to consume more paper than we did. That actually there's more paper used today than there was before digital media. So my office is going to look largely the same. If I was giving advice to someone who wanted to go into publishing, I'd say have a really good background in digital technology, because there's a lot of challenges there, but also a lot of excitement for what can be done with books. And the people who are really engaged in our business are those who are just solving problems and who can really monitor what's happening in the digital environment from day to day. There's an awful lot of books getting promoted now on Facebook, on Twitter. If you can follow where the digital culture is going, you can be a very successful publisher at this point.
Question up front here.
Yeah. Like most of us here, I grew up with books, and a lot of this is kind of frightening and overwhelming. But every 18 months, the technology doubles. So that means in 5 years that we probably haven't a clue as to what it's going to look like. And, you know, you look at TV as an example, for instance, has gone from black and white to 3D. And the next thing that's coming along, I'm sure, is holographic TV because it's already in the background and the lab's being done.
Mm-hmm.
And that means you turn on the TV and the TV actors to be right in your living room. And you might have something similar like that going on in the book or publishing industry. And the books that you're holding now will be nice relics.
You know, there's people who believe that's exactly what will happen, and who can even tell you what a book is going to look like and how they'll be consumed. There are people who will tell you, we're not even going to read full books. We're going to just cruise from text to text and author to author, and we'll rewrite them ourselves. They're all out there, but I'm not really from the visionary wing of publishing. You know, I sort of take the landscape as I see it, and I think there is something incredible that happens when you're reading. It's often called an immersive experience, that when you read, somehow your mind just goes someplace else. And Nicholson Baker, the novelist I mentioned earlier who rescued all those newspapers, he wrote a hilarious piece in The New Yorker on trying to read a book on a Kindle and just what it was like. And just this stupid piece of plastic where the pages kept, things kept flipping when he didn't want them to, and it was gray and it was unpleasant. And in about an hour and a half, he found himself totally immersed in the story and was exactly where he always was when reading a book. And that's by someone who's about as much of a paper devotee as you can ask for. So yeah, I don't know where it's going. I've tried to read books on my iPad, and I find it pretty alienating, and I'm not even sure what the point is. A friend of mine says that if you spend all your work day on a screen, it doesn't feel like much of an escape to then go home and turn on a screen and still be doing it. But we're just going to find out.
Are some of you curious like I am? I'd love to do a quick survey here. How many of you either have e-books or have them on your Christmas list?
Wow.
Yeah. Interesting. Very interesting.
That looks right on target, right around that 50% mark, 50% mark.
Sherry, got a question back here.
Yeah, you had referenced earlier carbon footprint, and then I was surprised to hear you say that more paper is used now, because my question was going to be, what about the trees? You know, if we don't have so many books, does that mean a lot fewer trees cut down? Can you say more about why more paper is used now?
Yeah, I mean, it's more paper being used in all sorts of different ways, but it's partly because more text, more information is flowing, there's more communications, and people do just print those things out. But the carbon footprint is a complex issue, of course, because, you know, computers are not without their own footprint. You know, these servers are running by and large on electricity. Electricity by and large is coal-fired. Coal is not a renewable resource, and trees are. Running a personal computer in a house is, for an entire year, consumes about the same amount of energy as driving a Cadillac Escalade across the country and back. You know, computers use up a lot of electricity. So there's really no way to escape it. But we can do better. You know, we can just do a lot better. And a lot of us are using, a lot of us have, the University of Minnesota Press is part of something called the Green Initiative. And about 70% of the paper we use is post-consumer recycled paper. So we're sort of doing the best we can to help build a market for that. And it is more expensive, but it's something we feel we need to do.
You know, just to show how visionary Margie Ligon is, who produces this this series and several others, our next month's headliners in January is Professor Masoud Amin, who's doing research on the smart grid. Smart electrical grid. In fact, you may see him on TV in some of these Driven to Discover ads that the U has on.
Huh.
Yeah. So next month, see you back here. Over on the right here.
Hi. I work for an educational publisher, and I work on the image side of things. So I've been dealing with the, you know, past books that were only licensed for, or images that were only licensed for print that we can't go digital, and everything forward we're trying to license for print and digital, and so it's a really complicated equation, but I'm kind of, and part of the question is how libraries are going to be selling this educational content or distributing it, and how we can track these books that, and one thing that they're looking at is sort of piecemealing these books by chapter, or kind of creating databases out of book content.
The chunking idea.
Right. So I guess with educational books are maybe more susceptible to chunking than fiction and that kind of thing. But
I think that, you know, libraries are going to be a big part of the solution to a lot of these problems, because libraries, there's a lot of libraries, but not as many as there are individuals. Libraries can, you know, get together and say what they need and help to solve some of these problems. And libraries have been very concerned for a while with the sort of limitations, especially on things like illustrated matter and also sound, that are very difficult to move forward in the digital age. And one solution to that, which has come up, is sponsored by the Mellon Foundation, something called Art Store, where Mellon has been working directly with museums that control those rights to clear images for educational use. And the idea is that these ebook databases that we're all talking about building will then be linked to Art Store in a way that if an image is cleared once for, you know, an educational publisher, it's for Blackwell, it's also cleared for the University of Minnesota Press, it's cleared for Princeton University Press, it's just one image that everyone is sharing. And that could really make it an awful lot easier. But it's a big problem.
And one more question. How do you see libraries distributing this content if most people don't have e-readers?
Well, I think it's what I really hope is that it's going to be on the web. One of the weird statistics out there is that for all we talk about e-readers, 40% of books read are read on computers, on laptops or on desktops, which really surprised me, because we're constantly talking. We judge the size of the e-book market by how many Kindles are sold and how many Nooks are sold, partly because Amazon won't tell us how many books they're selling, but we won't get into that right now. So a lot of people are reading things on that environment. So I really think that the internet itself provides the platform. Google's program, which is going to launch, is actually going to provide you with a choice of having a flowable text like on Kindle, but also just having straight PDF pages, so that we can preserve all of our notes, we can preserve all of our page layouts, we can actually show people what a book looks like on screen. And I think the Google program is really going to be revolutionary when it hits.
Will you take one last question here? We have lots of questions, haven't we? Over here on the left.
Okay. My question is, do major publishing houses have a financial incentive to push this technology, or do they have a financial incentive to sort of hold it up? They already own the means of production of books and transportation and their whole infrastructure, and now it's all shifting away from them out of control. Do they have sort of a financial incentive to sort of slow down this technology, try and hinder it, and try and keep books around as long as they can?
There's definitely no slowdown in the technology. And the first answer is that they and we don't know. We have no idea what the impact is going to be. If the entire print marketplace evaporates, that's going to really be bad, because right now the print marketplace is paying for the electronic marketplace. But again, publishers have been studying all these other industries, especially the music industry, and seeing the mistakes they made. And there's a general belief that you can't hold this up. Every major publisher in the country has a digital division. They're all moving to make their front and backlist books available. This is all going to happen, and happen really fast. Ebooks through Amazon alone, you know, have grown by 200 or 300% this year. Someday Amazon will tell us what the exact numbers are. So we all see that it's a way to go, and we think it could lead us towards a better environment, but we still don't know exactly how it's going to shake out.
Well, Doug, the University of Minnesota is certainly lucky to have you directing its University of Minnesota Press, and it's quite a prestigious press. And this has been just such a sweeping and enlightening conversation this evening. We want to thank you so much. Join me in thanking Doug.